Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop, Mantle Cell Lymphoma Update. And this is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and we're delighted with all of you on the call today. And it is also a collaborative effort between a number of other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 615 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the country and regions and like urban and suburban, rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants on the call today from Argentina, Australia, Canada, China, England, India, Korea, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, really a group of information seekers. Today's program has been supported through grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program, and particularly the Lymphoma Research Foundation for their support of many of these programs over a number of years. It's been a wonderful collaboration with the Lymphoma Research Foundation and offering many programs throughout the year. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of our collaborating organizations, as resources for you, information about the Lymphoma Research Foundation, as well as Cancer Care as well. And there also is information about just our programs in general. Now, there's also an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are our best guides as to what programs we should offer. Many of you, I have to say, have requested a program on mantle cell lymphoma. It's been a kind of frequent request from the lymphoma community, and we're delighted to offer this program today. But it really is, we really try very hard to perform what you ask us to do. We feel that's very important, and rather than our just coming up with ideas, it's best that it come from you, because then we know it's going to be relevant to meet your needs. So please take a moment at the end of the program today and complete the evaluation form. Again, your feedback is critically important to make these programs most helpful to you. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Leo Gordon. Dr. Gordon is Abby and John Friend Professor of Cancer Research, Professor of Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program, Medical Director, John and Lillian Matthews Cellular Therapy Laboratory, Division of Hematology Oncology, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University, Feinberg School of Medicine. And it's really a pleasure to have Dr. Gordon on the call today, and he's going to address mantle cell lymphoma overview, treatment options for newly diagnosed, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Gordon.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. I think what I'd like to try to do in the beginning is to try and put mantle cell lymphoma into some perspective as it fits into the spectrum of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and then talk a little bit about some specific parts that can make us understand a little bit how we approach this disease. So to start, just to step back a second, we know there are probably about 70,000 new cases a year of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And by contrast, there's about maybe 8,000 to 9,000 cases of Hodgkin's lymphoma. So clearly non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is much more common than Hodgkin's. Non-Hodgkin's lymphomas tend to occur in people more often in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and Hodgkin's lymphoma is a disease of younger people, most often people in their 20s and 30s. If you look at the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, we understand a few things immediately. First of all, maybe 90% or so, maybe a little bit more than that, are what we call B-cell lymphomas. There's another 5% or so, maybe a little bit more, that are T-cell lymphomas, and another few percent where we can't really tell. Within the group of the B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, there may be 30 or more types. But for practical purposes, we think of two major types. We think of aggressive lymphomas, and we think of non-aggressive or low-grade lymphomas. And one of the questions, of course, that comes up is where in that sort of algorithm does mantle cell lymphoma fit in? So, and that's been somewhat problematic, actually, in trying to fit mantle cell lymphoma into the groupings of either aggressive or non-aggressive. In general, our thinking about the aggressive lymphomas, and that's typified by something called diffuse large cell lymphoma as the most common type, our thinking there is that patients who present with that diagnosis should be treated aggressively with chemotherapy with the object of trying to achieve a complete remission and a cure. Our thinking on the non-aggressive lymphomas has been that patients very often don't need treatment right away. They can be observed for a period of time. And we think of the non-aggressive lymphomas perhaps a little bit more like a chronic disease, a chronic disorder, like sometimes we think of diabetes or sometimes we think of rheumatoid arthritis. And so very different treatment philosophies. Mantle cell lymphoma, we've had difficulty sort of pigeonholing. Initially, mantle cell lymphoma, when you look at it, a biopsy specimen under the microscope, looks more like the non-aggressive lymphomas. And in fact, for many years, we tended to view them as a non-aggressive lymphoma and treat patients with a sort of a watch and wait or observation sort of a mode. And I think what we soon discovered was that the disease didn't really fit any labels. Labels didn't adhere to this disease very well because it had some features of non-aggressive lymphomas and some features of the aggressive lymphomas. And in fact, a number of years ago, and things have changed dramatically, so that's what I want to stress, but a number of years ago, we tended to think it had some of the negative features of the aggressive lymphomas and some of the negative features of the non-aggressive lymphomas. So what happened was we were observing much more aggressive courses if we watched and didn't treat, and we were observing more recurrences if we treated in a more traditional way. Some of the worst features of both, so our treatment approach, we think, has changed over the years in the mantle cell lymphomas. And we'll get to that in just a second. Mantle cell lymphomas probably make up maybe of that group of 70,000 non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, make up maybe 5 to 10% of those cases. So not a common disorder. I think as we develop better diagnostic techniques, and there are new diagnostic techniques which have evolved out of a better understanding of the biology of the disease, I think we're going to see that the incidence of mantle cell lymphoma is probably a little bit higher than that. One of the major features in the diagnosis is, first of all, to look under the microscope, and you can of a biopsy specimen, usually a lymph node biopsy, or in some patients we see an elevated white blood count, for example. And we can look at those cells under the microscope, and we get a pretty good suspicion that they're lymphoma and a pretty good suspicion that they're mantle cell lymphoma. But what was recognized a number of years ago, as we understand the DNA a little bit better and we understand the molecular biology of these diseases better, is that there's a specific exchange of DNA from one chromosome to another. And specifically, we're looking for an exchange of material from chromosome number 11 to chromosome number 14. And that so-called 11-14 translocation is sort of the hallmark of mantle cell lymphomas. And in patients where we suspect it might be there, we look for that chromosome translocation. And that's probably the reason we're going to see more cases, I think, because we can diagnose it a little better than we used to be able to. It tends to occur in men a little bit more than in women. The average age is probably around 60. And as in most of the non-aggressive lymphomas, it tends to involve the bone marrow. And not infrequently, it tends to involve the gastrointestinal tract, the GI tract. So sometimes we make the diagnosis on a colonoscopy or on an upper endoscopy. And in fact, we found a number of patients who are having routine screening colonoscopies because they're over 50 looking for a colon tumor. but in fact we find cases of mantle cell lymphoma. So that's another way that it can show up. In general, patients have either enlarged lymph nodes or perhaps an enlarged spleen, or maybe have the colonoscopy or maybe go to their doctors because they're noticing that they're feeling full after eating and the spleen gets a little bit enlarged, or they may notice that they go in for a routine blood count and the white blood count is a little bit elevated. So those are the way that, the disease can present. So once the diagnosis is made, the staging usually includes tests like CAT scans. Sometimes PET scans are done. Very often a bone marrow will be done. And sometimes we will look at the gastrointestinal tract to see if it's present there. So what has happened over the course of the years is that the treatment has changed from a sort of observation approach to a more aggressive treatment approach. And one of the therapies that was used was the introduction of a fairly aggressive chemotherapy with the so-called CHOP regimen, which is a regimen that's used in the aggressive diffuse large cell lymphomas. And perhaps about 10, now maybe 15 years ago, the drug Rituxan or rituximab was developed initially for low-grade lymphomas, but it's become clear that Rituxan has changed the outlook, I think, for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And now I would say that in just about every situation, Rituxan is included as part of the treatment regimen in mantle cell lymphoma. So CHOP is, or Rituxan CHOP, or R-CHOP, is one of the standard approaches. And then people began looking at ways to improve the results, because we found that with R-CHOP alone, unlike the diffuse large cell lymphomas, unlike the aggressive lymphomas, patients get remissions, but those remissions didn't last as long as we would like, or as long as we expected. So the number of investigators, number of institutions around the country, and we were involved with this, started doing stem cell or bone marrow transplants as a first treatment once people, patients achieved a remission with drugs like, regimens like R-CHOP. And so transplant became a sort of accepted part of the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma. And in fact, we found that the remissions improved, the duration of remissions improved, and in fact, we had many patients with who remained in remission for many, many years. And we even begin to think about talking about cures with stem cell transplant. And it became sort of a standard of care to use transplant as part of the treatment algorithm for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. Then there were data developed with other treatment regimens. There's a drug regimen which is a little bit more aggressive than R-CHOP, and that's something called Hyper-CVAD, which was actually developed for children at Children's Memorial Hospital here in Chicago, and then ultimately developed used at MD Anderson Hospital. And that regimen was used for patients with mantle cell lymphoma together with Rituxan. And we started seeing prolonged remissions just with that regimen. And in fact, the question was raised, do we really need to do transplants if we use the R-hyper-CVAD regimen as the initial treatment? So, you know, I think that R-CHOP followed by transplant, Rituxan hyper-CVAD, not followed by transplant, we've done a sort of a retrospective look at data, and it appears that those two are about equal in terms of efficacy, remission rates, and the duration of remissions. So clearly, those two treatments remain important treatments for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. There are some newer treatments, and some of these treatments can be more difficult in patients that are may have other medical problems, may have heart problems or lung problems, or are a little bit older. The Rituxan hyper-CVAD or R-CHOP regimens may be more difficult. And so there are newer regimens that are now being investigated and look quite promising. And then one of those is the introduction of a drug called bendamustine in a drug which is really developed in Germany many years ago but is now used in clinical trials in the United States. And that's another treatment option for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. And then there are a group of patients that do very well with a drug called cladribine. There's a group of investigators in the country that feel that the drug cladribine, which is relatively non-toxic, may have quite a bit of activity in patients with mantle cell lymphoma, and we've seen prolonged remissions with that as well. So one of the questions that does come up is, after treatment, should there be some maintenance treatment? And, of course, one of the drugs that has been looked at for maintenance treatment is the drug Rituxan. We know that in the low-grade lymphomas now, there's increasing evidence that Rituxan given as a maintenance after the initial treatment may be beneficial. And until recently, there was some question about mantle cell lymphoma, but in the last several months or so, there are data from the German mantle cell lymphoma group that suggest that there may be, in fact, an advantage to maintenance Rituxan in patients once they achieve a remission with either R-CHOP or R-HyperCVAD. So I think that clearly aggressive therapy has been the norm. There are a group of patients, maybe 10, 15, maybe 20% of patients, who have a very slow course or a very indolent course. And in fact, now there are a group of patients that we may be able to just observe, like we do in some of the low-grade lymphomas, and who just do just as well for many years. So we're beginning to understand that it's not just one disease. There are probably different manifestations of the disease and different biologies that can lead us down different treatment paths. So Rituxan CHOP, Rituxan with a transplant, Rituxan HyperCVAD, cladribine and Rituxan, and possibly observation remain some of the initial treatments of choice. I think what is clear, though, is that as you're going through treatment, it's pretty important to have a healthcare team, a group of people that are involved in your care with whom you communicate on a regular basis. And that includes certainly the physician, the nurses, pharmacists, pathologists, and radiologists to some extent, who help us determine whether we've achieved the goals of remission. So I think it's important for people to understand that kind of communication with the healthcare team. So I think what I'll do is stop at this point to try and stop with that overview, and then let Dr. Call talk a little bit about what to do in case this disease were to recur, and talk a little bit about some new clinical trials.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Gordon, for just an outstanding and really very informative overview and lots of information. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Brad Call. Dr. Call is Associate Professor, Director of Lymphoma Service, University of Wisconsin, School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also Associate Director for Clinical Research, University of Wisconsin, Carbone Cancer Center. And Dr. Call is going to address treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, clinical trials, and emerging treatment approaches, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Call.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm happy to talk to everybody today about the issue of relapsed mantle cell lymphoma and the other issues that you heard. And relapsed mantle cell is a little more complicated as a topic than frontline treatment. And it's because there's a lot of variables that come into play. So when we see a patient who has recurrent mantle cell lymphoma that has come back after initial treatment, there's a whole variety of factors that we have to take into consideration. These include what treatments has the patient received previously, how well did those treatments work, how old is the patient now? What kind of other health problems does the patient have that we need to factor into our decision-making? What are the goals of treatment? How aggressive do we want to be with the treatment? What quality of life issues do we want to keep in mind with the treatment? Because sometimes there's not an absolute right or wrong answer. There are trade-offs. And so a lot of times this just takes a lot of back and forth between the physician and the patient and the family and trying to weigh through the different options and the pros and the cons of different options. So let me talk a little bit more specifically about these options. And I think I'll start with one of the more complicated options and try to get that out on the table right away, and that's the idea of doing what's called an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And allogeneic stem cell transplant means that the patient receives basically a new immune system from a donor. And the donor is usually a sibling, although it can be an unrelated donor who is a match at certain, we call it an HLA match. You're matched for certain immunological characteristics. It's not a blood type match. It's a different kind of a match. And there's actually a worldwide registry that we can look in to try to find matches for patients who don't have sibling donors. And we believe this strategy of an allo transplant has the potential to cure some patients with mantle cell lymphoma. So you might say, well, why don't you do that for everybody if it has the potential to cure? And the reason is, quite honestly, is that it's a risky procedure. It's very risky. There are lots of complications, lots of bad things that can happen as a result of an allo stem cell transplant. So it's a very, it's a high-risk, high-reward strategy. So what are the complications? Well, you're getting a new immune system when you get an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And sometimes, well, what we want to happen is we want the new immune system to attack the cancer and keep it away. And sometimes the new immune system actually attacks the patient's healthy organs instead of the cancer. And that's called graft versus host disease. And graft versus host disease can be a very serious and debilitating problem for patients, where the disease can attack the skin, the intestines, the liver. People can have can attack the lungs, so people can have trouble with breathing, trouble with eating, trouble maintaining their weight, trouble with infections. So that's the downside of an allo transplant. And when you look at statistics or data on allo transplant, it looks like about 20 to 30% of patients will die from a complication of that kind of a transplant in the first year or two. So that's not a death from the disease. It's a death from the complication of the treatment. And that's the reason that one has to be very thoughtful and very careful about recommending that procedure. And it requires really extensive discussions and careful consideration before embarking down that pathway. Now, for patients who don't have those dreaded complications, then there is the potential that it will keep the disease away for a long time, possibly even forever. And so it is a strategy that I think should be considered for certain patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. And there are two kinds of allogeneic transplants. There's what we call the full transplant, and there's what we call the mini transplant. And that just refers to the amount of chemotherapy that one receives prior to receiving the donor cells. And to make a long story short, a mini transplant means you get much less chemotherapy and it's much easier to get through in the short run, although that has the same kind of risk for these long-term complications of graft versus host disease. So allotransplant is one of the things that we'll consider for some patients with relapsed mantle cell. Another thing that could be considered is something that Dr. Gordon mentioned earlier, which is an autologous stem cell transplant where the patient uses their own stem cells. That's not used as commonly for relapsed mantle cell as it is for frontline mantle cell, and that's because the data would suggest that autologous stem cell transplantation is not as effective, but for some patients it can be a useful strategy. Now, other options for relapsed mantle cell include regular sorts of chemotherapy options. So you can look and see what the patient may have had previously and how well that worked, and then you can pick either go back to the same regimen, although we don't use that very often, or you go to different regimens using different drugs that work in a different way and hope that you can put the patient back in remission and have a good quality remission that way. So, for example, if a patient was treated with, Rituxan and CHOP chemotherapy initially and relapses several years later, something like bendamustine and rituximab would be an option. There are chemotherapy regimens that use drug called platinum agents. People might have heard of these. DHAP is one, RICE is one, so those are regimens that are sometimes used for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. There is a drug that is FDA approved for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma called bortezomib, and this is a unique class of drugs called the proteasome inhibitor. It kills cancer cells in a very unique way, and that drug is effective for recurrent mantle cell lymphoma, and we sometimes use that drug either by itself or in combination with rituximab. There are regimens that use all oral agents, which sometimes can be appealing to patients with relapsed mantle cell. There's a regimen called PEPCI, P-E-P-C, which uses four different chemotherapy drugs all given by mouth, and that can be a very effective regimen for recurrent mantle cell lymphoma. Sometimes we'll do some things as simple as trying single-agent rituximab. Single-agent rituximab is not extremely potent therapy for relapsed mantle cell, but it is very well tolerated. And so for some patients who are frail or elderly or who have comorbid conditions that make more aggressive treatments unattractive, single-agent rituximab can be a good choice. And another well-tolerated choice for selected patients is the use of just radiation treatments. It turns out mantle cell lymphoma is very sensitive to radiation, and so sometimes we'll just use what we call external beam radiation given to problem areas in patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, and that can be very effective for helping control the disease for prolonged periods of time. Now, we also have some new drugs that are in development that look promising for mantle cell lymphoma. These include agents like a drug called lenalidomide. Lenalidomide is a drug that's taken by mouth, and its mechanism of action is complicated, but it seems to help activate and trigger the immune system to help fight the cancer. And lenalidomide is looking fairly promising in some studies right now. It's not yet approved for mantle cell lymphoma, but we hope it will be someday. There's another drug that's in clinical trials right now called Cal-101, Cal-101. And this is another unique drug with a unique mechanism. This drug targets a intracellular pathway. So each cancer cell is like a little power plant, and it has all sorts of biochemical pathways happening at any one time. And if you can find pathways that you can disrupt with drugs, sometimes you can cause the cell to die. And that's what this drug Cal-101 does. It disrupts a very important biochemical pathway inside the cancer cells that causes the cancer cells to die. And Cal-101 is another drug that is oral. It's been very well tolerated in patients who have taken it to date, and we think this could be a very promising agent for recurrent mantle cell lymphoma, and this drug is also in clinical trial testing. There's a class of drugs called mTOR agents, stands for mammalian target of rapamycin, and this class of drugs also looks promising for relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. So we have several classes of drugs that are undergoing active study right now and we think have potential, which brings me to the topic of clinical trials. Clinical trials are the way that your doctors get smarter, quite honestly. This is a clinical trial is where patients are treated according to a very specific protocol that outlines the therapy that will be given in a very specific way. Many times the trials are using drugs that are not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration, so they're considered investigational. And clinical trials are just hugely important in oncology and in the world of cancer. And everything we know about how to treat cancer patients in 2011, we've learned from patients who have done clinical trials in the past. And this is really the only way we can keep the fields moving forward. And so it may happen at some time in a patient's disease course that a patient's physician will talk to the patient about the option of participating in a clinical trial. Clinical trial participation is always optional. It's always voluntary. Usually patients are provided other options that are not clinical trials in conjunction with the clinical trial options, but I'm a big believer in clinical trials, and if I have a clinical trial that I think is appropriate for a given patient, I will always present that as an option for them, and I'll explain the reason we do it. And obviously we hope the clinical trial proves to be a good option for the patient we're talking to, and furthermore, we hope that the clinical trial helps bring an agent along further, helps make the physician teams smarter, and helps improve the outlook for mantle cell lymphoma patients who will need these options in years to come. Finally, let me just talk a little bit about the issue of quality of life. And it's a hugely important issue, especially in a disease like mantle cell, where patients are very rarely cured of the disease. And so what we're trying to do for many patients is control the disease. We're trying to manage it. And we're trying to do so in a way in which our treatments do not become worse than the disease itself. So we want to find treatments that are highly effective and yet not too toxic. And sometimes there are trade-offs, and sometimes you will have choices of picking a very aggressive treatment with a lot of potential side effects and a lot of potential toxicity, and sometimes those treatments have a better chance of working, but it may come at some cost in terms of quality of life, and that will have to be then considered against maybe another option in which the treatment maybe isn't as aggressive, isn't as harsh, doesn't have as many side effects, but maybe the gentler treatment doesn't have the same probability of working well as the more aggressive treatment. And these are the kinds of discussions that are just very, very important to have with your healthcare team and trying to decide what's the best option for you as you move forward. And these scenarios are very specific from one patient to another. It requires very highly individualized discussions regarding what might be the best strategy for an individual. So I think that's all I wanted to say about the approach to relapse mantle cell lymphoma, clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. And I'll stop at this point, and I look forward to taking questions from the audience.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kauf, for really an outstanding presentation as well, and really for just covering these very important topics and being so very informative to everybody. And, yes, I suspect there will be lots of questions for you as well during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson. Brian is the Chief Program Officer of the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and I really see him also as the architect for all of our lymphoma programs. He's been incredibly involved in helping to select the speakers, the topics, and also the funding sources, and I can never thank him enough for really making it possible for this collaboration to occur, and it's really a pleasure to work with him and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. So I'm going to turn the program over to Brian, who's going to say some words of welcome to all of you, as well as describing the services of the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian?
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to you and your team at Cancer Care, as you said, for just an extraordinary partnership over a long period of time. We really appreciate the collaboration on this call and all the calls that we do together. I'd also like to welcome everybody that's on the call today. We're glad that you joined us, and I'm sure you found Drs. Gordon and Dr. Call's presentations very informative. The Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care have worked together for a number of years to better meet the needs of people affected by the disease. I'd like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Gordon and Call, for your taking the time to be with us today. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge Celgene and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company, for supporting the program. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused nonprofit organization, and we're devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing members of the lymphoma community with timely information on the disease. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. Our scientific advisory board is comprised of the world's leading lymphoma researchers and oncologists. This board formulates the foundation's research portfolio, seeking out the most innovative and promising lymphoma research projects for support. Both Drs. Gordon and Call are members of this prestigious board. In addition, the LRF Mantle Cell Lymphoma Consortium, which was formed in January 2005, is composed of more than 100 laboratory and clinical scientists from North America and Europe who focus their research efforts on mantle cell lymphoma. LRF is the world's largest private funder of mantle cell lymphoma research, and Dr. Gordon serves as the chairman of this consortium. To date, the organization has funded over $45 million in lymphoma-specific research. The LRF also provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for all people affected by lymphoma and for all of you on the phone. These programs include our Lymphoma Helpline and Clinical Trials Information Service, where our professional public health and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information and clinical trials. a lymphoma support network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. A variety of free publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease booklets for non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma, a number of disease-specific fact sheets, including fact sheets for mantle cell lymphoma as well as relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma, and a number of informational e-newsletters. We have a variety of webcasts and podcasts that are available on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. We have over 80 of these programs currently available on our website. We also offer in-person patient conferences on the local, regional, and national level. We have upcoming programs in Seattle on September 24th, in New York on October 1st and 2nd, and in Minneapolis on October 29th. For more information about any of these programs or for information about the organization, please contact a member of our Lymphoma Helpline team by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting our website, which is lymphoma.org. Again, thank you very much to Carolyn, Cancer Care, Drs. Gordon and Call, and Millennium and Celgene for supporting today's call. Carolyn?
Thank you very much, Brian, and thank you for your wonderful words of welcome. And also, I just want to say to everyone that the Lymphoma Research Foundation is just a wonderful resource for everybody on the call today. Many of you, I'm sure, have already contacted the foundation, but if you haven't, do contact them because they have wonderful resources for you. So thank you, Brian. Again, it's a pleasure to work with you. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker, and he is a blood cancers program coordinator, mind, body, spirit project coordinator at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to talk with you about the services that you can access from Cancer Care. And I'm going to turn the program over to Rick.
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Gordon and Call. Thank you very much. And especially the work of Lymphoma Research Foundation, as Brian stated, it's always a pleasure working with that organization. As Dr. Call stated, for mantle cell patients and families, there are numerous issues related to treatment. Many patients experience a watch and wait period, which can create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. Concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will take care of loved ones when you enter treatment are common questions. Changes brought on by treatment can affect sexual and body functions and challenge most people's self-image, eliciting feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. At the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. The good news is that at some point, the whole process will become more familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body, mind, and spirit, and help you maintain an enjoyable quality of life. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional from organizations such as Cancer Care. At Cancer Care, along with these Connect workshops, we offer financial assistance toward transportation to treatment, as well as information about other organizations and resources, and many fact sheets and booklets that can explain a lot of the things related to cancer treatments, as well as disease-specific. We also provide counseling by oncology social workers, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and those who care about them. Most important at Cancer Care, we provide the opportunity to speak with an oncology social worker who can help you identify people and resources in your community to address your needs as they arise. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. All our services are free. To many, support groups, social supports, and information to address practical and emotional issues go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. If you have questions or concerns or want to speak to a social worker, you can call 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for your very warm words of welcome and also for just describing all the different services that everyone can access from Cancer Care as well. And now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board, open all of our lines up, and we're going to start the questions. The other thing I wanted to say that if we, for some reason, there are so many of you on the call, if we are not able to take your question, or even if you think of a question later this afternoon or tomorrow, please contact Cancer Care, the Lymphoma Research Foundation, with your question. We're all happy to answer your questions. And I'll say more about that, repeat the numbers and everything that you can call. But now let's just go for the questions and see how many we can take. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Donald M.
Thank you very much. I'm in desperate need of some sort of treatment for mantle cell that will not make my peripheral neuropathy worse in my legs. I could just barely walk. I've had mantle cell for 16 years. And I had a lot of drugs, bendamustine you just mentioned. I wondered if that would increase the problem with mantle cell with peripheral neuropathy, because I can barely walk and I sure don't want to lose that ability.
Well, John, thank you. That's an excellent question. I suspect it's a question that many on the call would like to have an answer to as well. I'm going to ask Dr. Kahl if you would address that initially, if you could answer that. And I'm going to ask Dr. Kahl to address your question in a general way, and we're hoping that the information he gives you, you'll be able to take back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. Kahl?
Sure. So peripheral neuropathy is a complication of several of the different chemotherapy agents that we use to treat lymphomas, and it can become a very long-lasting and disabling complication for patients. I'm very sympathetic to the caller's situation. Certainly have lots of my own patients who struggle with peripheral neuropathy. So there are many agents we know that typically do not worsen pre-existing peripheral neuropathy, and so a drug like bendamustine should be safe to give and should not worsen peripheral neuropathy. The oral regimen that I mentioned, Pepsi, should not worsen peripheral neuropathy. Some of the investigational agents I mentioned, like, for example, the Cal-101 agent, does not appear to worsen peripheral neuropathy. And so there are definitely things that individuals with peripheral neuropathy can find that have a track record of success in mantle cell lymphoma.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Dr. Gordon, do you want to add anything in terms of just the challenge?
No, I mean, I would agree. I think that the neuropathy is a major issue, and for many of these drugs, the use of cladribine or 2-CDA is another agent that we have found doesn't really worsen peripheral neuropathy and clearly has activity if the blood counts will tolerate it. So those things that Dr. Kahl mentioned, and I would add cladribine to that possibility.
Excellent. Thank you, Donald. I hope that this information is helpful to you, and we do encourage you to speak to your healthcare team and also to speak to your healthcare team also about just some help for you in terms of just the neuropathy that you currently have, in terms of just sometimes people find involvement of rehab medicine or something to help you with that as well. That's really important as well, so that you're getting the very best care possible. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sharon D.
Yes, hi. This question is for Dr. Kahl. Do you have any new data on the safety and efficacy of long-term Rituxan maintenance? And how many years to date have you seen people doing that treatment with no relapse? And the same question for lenalidomide, please.
Sure.
Thank you. Dr. Kahl?
Well, it's a very good question. Dr. Gordon and I just saw some data presented at an international meeting a week ago that strongly supports the use of maintenance rituximab. For some patients with mantle cell lymphoma, the benefit was in patients who had received CHOP and rituximab as their initial therapy. And in this particular trial, the rituximab was given until disease progression. So meaning for some people it might be 1 year, some people 2 years, some people 5 years. The follow-up on the study isn't terribly long right now, and so there isn't a lot of long-term safety data from this particular study. So it's an emerging story. Now, I've been studying maintenance rituximab at my institution for about 10 years now, and we initially gave it for 2 years, and we found that to be safe and effective. And then we did another study in which we did it for 5 years, and that study was just accepted for publication. And it's my impression that 5 years looks to be safe, although we did start to see, I would say, some more problems with infections on the study in which we gave the maintenance rituximab for a longer period of time. Now, it didn't happen to everybody, so it became a problem in about 20% of people, which means in about 80% of people it wasn't a problem. So it's still an emerging story. There are studies ongoing right now that are comparing 2 years of maintenance rituximab versus 5 years of maintenance rituximab, and so those studies will be very interesting. In general, in my practice, I recommend 2 years right now and then stopping. But I'm going to let Dr. Gordon talk because he and I discussed this topic extensively at the meeting last week, and I know he does things slightly differently than I do, and I'm sure the audience would be very interested to hear his perspective on this.
So, no, I think I agree with everything Brad said there. We have an answer specifically to the question. I've had patients that have been on maintenance rituximab for up to 7-8 years and counting, and continue to do well after, usually after rituximab hypercvad as the induction regimen. The German study group that just presented the data that Dr. Call mentioned, was giving it until recurrence. So that was really open-ended rituximab. They didn't stop, at either 2 years or 5 years, although I agree that most of the data are based on either a 2 year or a 5 year time frame. So I think, you know, we certainly have seen patients, it's still in remission 7 years out and counting. That doesn't mean they're not side effects. And so we do see, as Brad mentioned, a slightly increase of sinus infections and bronchitis, and sometimes associated with low gamma globulin levels. So we've actually sometimes had to give gamma globulin infusions, either that or stop the rituximab at that point. So I think, you know, like any drug, I think if you use it indefinitely, there are bound to be some long-term effects. But I think that we're also going to learn from a study that Dr. Call is leading, not in mantle cell lymphoma, but in low-grade and follicular lymphomas, where patients receive either 4 weeks of rituximab or continue to get rituximab until recurrence. And so there'll be some patients who have had rituximab for a long period of time. So I think there is certainly reason to be optimistic about the data from Germany that was presented. And I do think there's a rationale now based in more than just kind of guessing that this might be effective.
There was a second question regarding the use of lenalidomide. There's much less data on lenalidomide use as a maintenance strategy. There's some studies that are just underway right now, just initiated, just starting to enroll patients where lenalidomide is being used as a way to try to maintain remissions, but we know far less about the use of lenalidomide in this setting, and so all I can tell the caller is it's an active area of an investigation, but we don't know what to recommend right now as far as lenalidomide use as a maintenance strategy.
And I would agree with that, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent questions and great answers. Very informative. Thank you. Our next question, please. These are great questions.
Our next question comes from Joel S.
Yes. I've been on Velcade, and it ended a year ago, but yet the side effects continue. How long does that normally last?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Gordon, could you address that question?
Sure. So a lot depends on the way it was given. The very often the twice-weekly Velcade is associated with a little bit more neuropathy, and we're beginning to see maybe a little bit less of that if it's given on a weekly schedule. But in answer to the question, we've sometimes seen it last for a good year or two, or sometimes even longer afterwards. And in people with underlying neuropathy or underlying diabetes, it may be even a little bit longer. I think what I would encourage for someone that still has neuropathy this far out after Velcade therapy is to begin looking at some alternative physical therapy. There's some medications which might alleviate that, and trying to speak to some of the support oncology groups that you may have at your institution, or they're certainly available at academic centers that may be able to help alleviate some of those symptoms. But it can last. Usually does get better, but it can last. Some symptoms can last for a couple of years afterwards. So.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Jerry C.
Yes. I have a lymph mantle cell lymphoma, and I believe I detected a tiny lump that led me to search about going on 4 years. Anyway, I'm out of the chemo treatment now and have been for close to maybe 3 months, and I have an appointment for Tuesday. And I might add, my main problem is in the GI tract, and so I just wonder what would be next.
Okay, well, thank you. That's an excellent question, Jerry. I'm going to ask Dr. Kahl to address your question in a general way, and then when you have your appointment on Tuesday, you'll be more informed about other questions that you might like to ask. Dr. Kahl, can you just take this in a general way?
Yeah, I'll try. The caller didn't really identify what the specific problem in the GI tract was, so it's a little hard to comment. Certainly some of our treatments cause upset with digestion. People can have problems with nausea, diarrhea, constipation. So I don't know if the caller is having a problem like that. But we do have different interventions that we can try for those different side effects. And so all I can say to the caller is to verbalize the problems as best you can to your doctor when you see him on Tuesday, and hopefully he can come up with a strategy to help deal with those side effects.
And when what you're saying, actually, it probably is relevant to everyone on the call, that these, if there are side effects, to tell the doctor. Do you want to say a word about that?
Well, sometimes I find out later that the patients kind of minimize things to me. They didn't want to come off as complainers or whiners, and all I can say is, hey, that's what we're here for. So please tell us everything you're experiencing, the good and the bad, because we just want to help you. So it's just very important that you communicate everything that you're experiencing, and that gives us the best chance of helping you.
Thank you so much. I hope everybody heard that. That's so important. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Dennis G.
I am in 3 years of complete remission following a successful clinical trial with single-agent lenalidomide. I'm 9 years out from my diagnosis in 2002, and now what I've inherited is myelodysplastic syndrome, and I'm in a watch and wait period with that. I'm interested in any information, ideas that you can give me about how to prevent progression of this MDS, or what are some promising treatment regimens on the horizon?
Well, thank you. It's an excellent question. I'm going to ask both Dr. Gordon and Dr. Kahl to address your question. It's a very good one, and they'll give you some general tips, and then you'll bring that to your healthcare team. Dr. Gordon?
Sure. Well, I think MDS is something we do see. MDS is sort of, we think, probably one of the side effects of perhaps intensive chemotherapy. I don't know if there was a prior stem cell transplant or prior use of fairly aggressive chemotherapy, but we do sometimes see MDS, which is a disorder that where the blood cells aren't made normally, sometimes can evolve to a more serious disorder such as leukemia, but sometimes it just stays as MDS and the blood counts stay a little bit on the low side. There are actually, interestingly, there's specific types of MDS which may respond, ironically, to lenalidomide. And so if the caller has one of those specific types of MDS, lenalidomide might possibly be reintroduced into the treatment algorithm. If the MDS doesn't respond or does get worse, In certain situations, the stem cell transplant, the allogeneic stem cell transplant that Dr. Call talked about earlier, might be an option to treat disorders like MDS. But again, all of the caveats that Dr. Call mentioned, the side effects, the age of the person, the other medical problems, would have to go into the thinking about whether that would be an appropriate step or not. So a lot depends on what type of MDS, what the symptoms are, age of the patient, and other medical problems as to what the best treatment might be.
Thank you. And Dr. Call?
Not much to add to what Dr. Gordon just said. Just a few years ago, there were really no great drug treatments for MDS, and there are some effective drug treatments now. Dr. Gordon mentioned lenalidomide can be effective in a certain situation, and there are some other classes of drugs, things called hypomethylating agents and things called histone deacetylase inhibitors that seem to have some good activity in myelodysplastic syndromes. Not everybody needs those agents, but for people who have really low blood counts, those can be effective too.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. It's been an outstanding group of speakers, just wonderful, all of you. I want to thank all of our people who've queued up and asked such great questions. And also I want to thank all of you who've been listening. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program and that when a program like this is planned, we realize that you all have many needs that really go beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so I do want to remind all of you that although the program will end soon, the services that you can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, those services are endless for each of you. You can, and they're free services, and you can contact them with your questions and really take advantage of these services. So I want to really, again, you have it in your materials, but I want to be sure everybody has the phone number for the Lymphoma Research Foundation, which is 1-800-500-9976. And for Cancer Care, 1-800-813-4673. And all of us have staff that are here designated to answer your questions, to spend time with you, and to really, I think some of you ask questions like you're going to a doctor's appointment, you want to kind of think about what to do. Take advantage of these organizations for things like that or for any questions that you may have. And, again, I want to thank you all for participating today. I don't want anyone to leave this call thinking that you're alone in coping with mantle cell lymphoma. I want you to now know that you're part of the community of support and that help is really just simply a telephone call away or a mouse click away in terms of the preferred technology that you want to use to contact us. But most importantly, we are here to help you, and I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.